I'm Marty Moscoane, and today it's the Best of Radio Times, part of WHYY's mini membership drive. We want to end it today, and we will with your pledge of support at 1-888-345-9499. We're playing excerpts of interviews that you enjoyed, beginning with writer Pat Conroy. Chances are you read his book, The Great Santini, or you saw the movie. It was based on his mercurial and abusive father. Conroy stopped by our studio last year to talk about his memoir, The Death of Santini. I asked him if this book was a last rite for his difficult relationship with his father.
You know, I've been writing about this family for 40 years. I think it's the only subject I've ever written about. It is time for me to move on to something else. And there are many subjects I have not yet dealt with. You know, there's certain stories that, in fact, my family has been, my Chicago Irish family wants me to write a story about the Chicago Irish, but I know nothing about them. There are different parts of my Southern family that think I denigrated the Southern branch. They would like me to do it. But for me, it was always the personal psychodrama that took place within my own family, my mother and father, the seven kids. Right. They produced six miscarriages, and I thought, you know, the miscarriages were the luckiest people on earth. I mean, and my sister always thought they heard what was going on and just said, no way, man, I'm not going in to that.
Well, as I said, and you write in your book that you said, I hated my father long before I knew there was a word for hate. You were a little boy.
I
hated didn't have
that.
Language, but you had hate.
I hated him when I was in diapers, and I hated him when I was being fed. My first memory was of my father beating my mother to the floor with a backhand and her trying to stab him with a butcher knife. And this to me was, hey, Pat, welcome to the world. And this became such a, you know, an obvious token of what my life was going to be like, what the life of my brothers and sisters was going to be like. And my mother suffered through it for 33 years.
Mm. In fact, you write that your siblings used denial and repression, whereas you, the oldest son, you remembered everything. Was that your fate in life somehow?
You know, I think I was fated to remember. When I would go back to ask my brothers and sisters, look, okay, here is what I remember. Tell me what you remember. Almost invariably, nothing. Now, my brother Mike works in the He's now retired in the South Carolina Mental Hospital for 35 years. And he was an administrator there. And what Mike would tell me all the time, he'd say, Pat, everybody who is a permanent resident of Bull Street, which is what we call it in South Carolina, everybody in Bull Street lacks all powers of denial. They have no powers of denial, therefore they're crazy. I have developed great powers of denial, and I love my powers of denial. I wouldn't give them up for anything. I think denial is a form of health.
And he this thought, is your brother talking.
Yes, my brother, who worked with the mentally ill for his whole life. And he said, mental illness to me is defined by you. You who remember everything, even when it's so painful, it leads you towards suicide and depression and breakdown all the time, and I seem healthier than you do to me.
Do you think he's right?
I think he's on to something. I tell Mike he's right. And it's something that, you know, I've known my whole life that eventually I was going to have to turn to this. And if I was going to tell a story, the one I had to tell was forbidden to tell. I knew this was true with the Irish Catholics. I knew it was true with the Southern mountain people of my mother, and I knew it was going to be a betrayal, a Judas-like act. Once, you know, I brought this out in the open, and frankly, I was stunned. Even though I knew this, I was stunned by the ferocity of the reaction of my family on both sides when The Great Santini came out, and I am waiting for this one.
But do you trust your memory? And I ask you that if you live with people who deny things that you believe happened, and they all deny them, and you're the storyteller, and memory can be a fuzzy thing, and we can distort our own memories, thinking mm-hmm. that they're very real.
You know, I trust my memory pretty well. And the one thing I've always done, because I'm mouthy and I have a big mouth, I've always retold the stories that happened to us. And all the kids know these stories because we have discussed them so many times. You know, my brother Tim brought up the subject, was dad ever nice to us?
Yes.
Did he ever do one nice thing to us in his whole life? And we sat there, all seven of us, thinking, did he buy us an ice cream cone? No. Did he take us out for a hot dog? No. Did he take us to a ball game? No. We could come up with nothing that he ever did, just naturally being nice, naturally being a father. And we can come up, now that we're older, we come up with excuses for dad. But at that time, we could mm-hmm. come up with absolutely nothing except he seemed to like to be mean. He seemed to like to be dictatorial, authoritarian, and he seemed to like to hurt people.
Mm. It must be such a burden to feel that you hated your father. I mean, a burden for the child to carry that kind of hate. And I have to say, without giving too much of the book away, I mean, I don't know if reconciliation is too strong a word, but you certainly, after The Great Santini was published, your father became your defender because the family was very angry at you for exposing all these secrets and I guess telling tales. And your dad was there to defend you to some degree.
Yeah, you know, the biggest surprise of my life was when The Great Santini was published. Dad evidently threw the book across the room, stomped it, disappeared for days. His whole family would call me, say he's killed himself. Nice going, Pat. You killed your father. And, of course, I felt horrible. But Dad hears his family is jumping on me, so he comes back and writes him a letter saying that his son wrote this book. He'd read it. He said he loved the description of the mother, the children, the Marine Corps, but his son did not have enough talent. His son did not have enough greatness. His son did not have enough vision to write about the great Santini himself.
Mm.
And that was the only failure in the book. So he then started signing books with me for the rest of his life, wherever I went. He'd be in a signing line of mine. His favorite moment is he would look up and he'd look over at me and he'd say, "My line's longer, son."
Wow. Were you surprised that he sort of embraced this portrait that you painted of him?
He embraced it in such a way you would not have. Dad died thinking he was responsible for Robert Duvall's career. Before he played me, son, he had no roles with any meat on it, any masculinity on it. And I said, "Dad, Apocalypse Now, The Godfather, yeah, he did okay." He said, "But he couldn't carry a movie until he played the great Santini. I made that man." And I said, "Dad, it's your modesty that Hollywood looks for most of all." But, you know, he thought it was stupid killing Santini at the end. And I said, "Why?" And he said, "It messed up the sequel."
My goodness. Well, but do you think your father turned you into a writer, and your father's abusive behavior made you a writer?
Yeah, it made me one. And I think it turned my sister into a poet in New York. And I think coupled with my mother's extraordinary love of reading, her love of books, her love of story, to mix in this incredibly violent family, and especially the family that holds secrets.
I also got the feeling in reading this book that there were moments in your life where you felt you were rather like your dad. And part of it with a temper, you talk about your brother, Tom, who committed suicide, but having to deal with him and feeling the kind of rage and frustration and anger at him that for whatever reason, it seems your father felt towards his family.
You know, the brothers in the family, we have a game we play. It is a horrible game. It's called MLD, Most Like Dad. Mm. And we'll sit around at Thanksgiving or Christmas and we'll just be talking, and somebody will say something, and there'll be a gesture or a motion or a look or a tone. And one of the brothers says, they'll point at the offender and say, MLD, MLD. And we all know we're like him in various degrees, and it kills us.
But as you said, there were times in your life where you felt like you were, you know, a slightly softer version of your father.
But truth is, deep down, Marty, I am the same guy. I was raised in a household where I saw a mother abused. That kid almost always ends up an abuser. It's a constant struggle, a constant battle for me every day of my life not to be like him. If I ever hit a wife, I'm going to kill myself. I don't want to hit my kids. I just don't want to be that guy. Yet I can feel Dad living in my bloodstream, coming out in my anger, my fury. And sometimes I put that anger in my books.
A very complicated relationship. Pat Conroy talking about his father, known as the Great Santini. He wrote a novel called The Great Santini, and we were talking about his most recent book, a memoir called The Death of Santini. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne with Susan Greenbaum. We're taking a very short break in this hour of Radio Times. It's the best of Radio Times. We're playing excerpts of interviews that you enjoyed, and we want to make sure that you become a member here at WHYY. And we're thrilled because the Kensington Business High School DECA Marketing Club, give yourselves a round of applause. They are here to take your phone call. We love having students here, and we do want to put them to work. They're here to take your call at 1-888-345-9499. It's the membership drive, a mini drive. We want to get to our goal and get it over with.
Marty, as you know, we have a goal of 80 listeners
right.
during this hour to give us a call, become a member of WHYY. Marty, I am so glad we are re-airing this interview because it really was one of our favorites. And clearly from the response we got from our listeners, one of theirs, it was a probing, revealing interview. And it was a privilege to be in the studio with Pat Conroy. My hunch is that if you're listening to us now, it's this is the kind of programming you appreciate, you value, and the way to show us how important this is to you is to become a member of WHYY. Please do give us a call, 1-888-345-9499. WHYY.org is the place to pledge online.
One of the things that we really enjoy on Radio Times, and Susan is one of the producers, and people often ask me, well, what does a producer do? Well, they track down guests. They bring them into the studio. They do the research. They manage the schedule, which is, as you can imagine, a very complicated schedule. We love having guests in the studio, and particularly novelists, and particularly people like Pat Conroy, excuse me, who was so personal and so honest. I mean, almost scarily honest. But I often... And I regularly believe that radio is a place where people can be very honest and very intimate and very personal. It really works. And that's why we do the show. We believe that's why you listen to Radio Times. Again, we have a goal of 80. It's a big goal. We can do it. We did it yesterday. And we can certainly do it today. And we want to put these students from Kensington Business High School's DECA Marketing Club to work. They are here. I would say we have about 15 of them. And we appreciate them being with us. You are with us as well. It's important to take that next step and become a supporter. And again, that phone number is 1-888-345-9499. You can also pledge online at WHYY.org. Radio Times is here for you every morning from 10 until 12, Monday through Friday, 52 weeks a year, Susan. We do a lot of radio
here.
We
do, and you said that to me this morning.
I did.
I just want to mention something, Marty. This is we're airing a segment of this interview, which was an hour long. That is a gift for folks like us who produce radio, to have an hour to have a thoughtful conversation, whether it's with an author. We'll hear from an author who talks about music. It really is a gift. And the fact is, it's folks like you who make that gift possible. And you make it possible because you support what we do here. You enable us to spend an hour talking with people that you're interested in, talking about issues that you're interested in. We can't do it without your support, and we really do need each and every one of you to give us a call. Pledge your support for WHYY. Become a member, 1-888-345-9499, WHYY.org.
And like you, we have bills. We have bills to pay, and we fell short during the winter campaign, but we are here to make it up. You're here as well. This is radio that, in a sense, we do together. We produce the interviews that you say you tell us that you enjoy, including this interview with Pat Conroy. We put it together. We're on the air with you. You can call into the show. You can send us emails. You can find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. Many ways that we are a community together. But it's so important to take that next step and become a supporter of WHYY and a supporter of Radio Times. It's a handmade show. Every day we put two interviews together, and we put it together lovingly with a great deal of care and a great deal of curiosity, which we think you share with us as well. So take that next step, but we do need to hit this goal, and we do need to hear from you at 1-888-345-9499. A couple of calls in, that's great, but it's not going to get us to 80. We need to hear from you right now.
It is a privilege to look around and see all these young people here,
yeah,
who are answering our phone calls, who are ready to talk to you. It is a reminder, Marty, for me, of the breadth of our listeners, just in terms of ages and ages and educational backgrounds, and really gives us a sense that you trust what we do. Please do show support for what we do here. Let us know that you trust us by becoming a member. Give us a call, 1-888-345-9499. We really can't do it without each and every one of you. We really do need your support.
Absolutely. And what we did for this special edition of Radio Times, the best of Radio Times, was to look back over the last 6 months and just find out, so what did the audience enjoy listening to? We were able to get that information, and then we have edited these shows down into very digestible chunks and giving you a chance to get a little taste of Radio Times, but also to give you the opportunity to make a pledge right now at 1-888-345-9499. We need to hear the phones ringing. I don't know how else to say that. We also need to hear from you online at whyy.org. Thank you very much. And we do rely on our listeners to make sure that that we remain strong and can continue to bring you the kind of news and information that you rely on. So thanks very much, and let's get back to Radio Times. Duke Ellington's name is associated with 1,500 compositions, including this famous one, Take the A Train, featuring Billy Strayhorn on piano and singer Betty Roche.
To find the quickest way to get to Harlem. If you should take the A train, you'd find you'll get where you're going if you hurry.
We have more music and conversation with Terry Teachout, drama critic for the Wall Street Journal and author of the biography Duke, in this excerpt of a recent interview. Today we examine this complicated and fascinating man behind the music.
Ellington comes from the black middle class of Washington, D.C., and he internalized its values, the desire for respectability. He believed devoutly in that, especially when he became a public figure, and he's a symbol of black pride and racial aspiration. He knows this, but he also knows that he wants to lead his life the way he wants to in private. And so right from the beginning, there's a disconnect between the public Ellington and the respectable public Ellington and the private Ellington, who is in the beds of, I suspect, thousands of women if an accurate count had been kept, and who became estranged from his wife not so long after they got married in the 20s. Put all these things aside, he's still the greatest jazz composer of the 20th century, one of the greatest American composers, period.
You say one of the supremely creative figures of the 20th century, but you also say a major composer, but not an influential one.
That's right.
Which I thought was interesting.
Well, to be influential, other people have to try to do what you do and imitate it, things like that. People played Ellington's songs, but they couldn't play the way his band played, because he wrote specifically for the individual musicians in the band, who were themselves extremely original idiosyncratic players. So you can write out an Ellington chart note for note, and they're published, you know. I mean, if you run a jazz band, you can buy an Ellington chart. But if you sit down and play it with your people, it's not going to sound the way that Ellington did when he sat down and played it with his people.
Well, I do want to play Mood Indigo, and this is 1930,
yes.
Composed with Barney
Bigard.
Bigard. Yeah. And let's listen, just it's about a minute and a half of Mood Indigo.
Okay.
Composed with Barney Bigard. We're talking about Duke Ellington, and you were telling me what Andre Previn said about this piece of music.
Yeah, Previn said that a guy like Stan Kenton could get up in front of a 100-piece orchestra and wave his arms, and they'd play this big explosion, and every studio arranger in Hollywood could say, oh yeah, he did this, this, and that. And Ellington gets up in front of his band and wags his finger, and three guys play a note, and Previn says, and I don't know what it is. And the piece he had in mind was this piece and that passage.
Well, and in the very beginning, it's that very muted sound. And we were talking as we were listening, and I mean, it sounds like the wind is blowing. Or there, it's just, it's almost uncanny.
Three in the morning music. I like
that. He paid his band members well.
He paid them very well. Better than any other black band leader, and better than nearly all white band leaders.
And how would you describe his relationship with them? Because you also described that a number of them had drinking problems, drug problems, and he would kind of look the other way,
yeah,
right?
That's sort right.
of it wasn't I mean, he wasn't going to deal with this.
His attitude was, you know, he hired you because he wanted you. He wanted your sound. And as long as you could function, and he defined that pretty broadly, you know, you lived the life you wanted to lead. You know, there were a couple of episodes where he had to bail people out of jail. Except on one spectacular occasion, he never fired anybody.
Wow.
But he could create a condition that would make you not want to stay in the band.
Let me play If It Don't Mean a Thing, If It Ain't Got That Swing, 1932, vocals by Ivy Anderson. Let's listen.
What I do.
I again. It don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. And that was Ivy Anderson singing. And Terry, you say she was his first and best female vocalist.
I think without a doubt. Just so hip, so swinging. And she had the attitude, that touch of irony, that touch of detachment. Just fit in perfectly with the band.
I want to play an excerpt of Black, Brown, and Beige. This is called The Blues. But first, help us understand the importance of this piece of music.
Ellington is one of the first jazz composers who tries to work on a large symphonic-like scale. Black, Brown, and Beige is his most structurally ambitious composition. It's a 45-minute large-scale piece written for his Carnegie Hall debut in 1943. The subtitle is A Tone Parallel to the American Negro. Huh. And that's what the title means. This is a portrait in sound of the history of the American black from the African emigration through slavery to what was then the present moment, World War II. And the movement we are going to hear is called the blues, and it's Ellington's epitome of the blues in black life.
And this is Betty Roche. Let's listen.
The blues ain't nothing. The blues ain't nothing but a cold gray day, and all night long it stays that way. Ain't something that leaves you alone, ain't nothing I want to call my own. Ain't something with sense enough to get up and go. Ain't nothing like nothing I know. The blues.
And again, an excerpt of Black, Brown, and Beige, composed by Duke Ellington, lyrics by Duke Ellington as well. And again, that beautiful voice of Betty Roche. The blues ain't nothing.
Yeah. Dark, dark harmonies, too, and dissonant ones. I mean, that's Ellington didn't borrow this from anybody, but you could listen to that and say, oh, Schoenberg, oh, Bartok. You know, I mean, your ear is immediately caught by these clashes of tonalities in a jazz composition from 1943.
And what did the critics have to say about Black, Blue, and Black, Brown, and Beige?
They blackened and blued it. Some of them did. They were all over the map. Back then, most of the people who wrote about this concert were classical reviewers, because you didn't have jazz reviewers in the newspapers yet. Some of them knew about jazz, dug what was going on. Some of them were utterly clueless. The reviews were all over the map. Ellington was deeply discouraged by them. He never again played the entire composition beginning to end after 1943.
After that Carnegie Hall concert?
After that, yeah.
Wow.
Tough.
I do want to play another excerpt, and this is actually jumping ahead to 1956 at the Newport Jazz Festival, but I'm curious about, so what happened between 43 and 56?
Well, World War II ends, the big band era ends, suddenly it's a world of pop singers like Sinatra, and then it becomes a world of youngsters like Elvis Presley. Where is the place for a guy like Duke Ellington in this changed world? And the answer is the gigs are starting to dry up. People are seeing him as history. He gets booked into the third Newport Jazz Festival in 56. Not a very good place on the program either. He's bringing up the rear, actually. So he comes on the bandstand. Everybody's saying, oh dear, it's Duke. He pulls out this piece, Diminuendo and Crescendo in Blue, written in 1937, turns the band loose on it. They go wild. Paul Gonsalves, the tenor sax soloist, plays, I think, 27 straight blues choruses in the middle of it. By the end of it, people are dancing in the aisles. They're shrieking. They go mad. 2 weeks later, Ellington's on the cover of Time magazine. Mm-hmm. And for the rest of his life, the dead letter of jazz is suddenly the most famous band leader in the world, and he stays that way.
Let's listen. This is a Diminuendo and Crescendo in Blue from the Newport Jazz Festival, 1956. Thank you. concert at the Newport Jazz Festival, 1956, a diminuendo and crescendo in blue. Someone posted on our Facebook page to you, Terry. I think this is one of his best live performances. Would you agree?
It's just hot as sin. You can see why they went wild. And you can hear Ellington in the background. He's yelling. He knows what's happening out there in the audience. And I think probably deep down inside, mm-hmm. he knew what it was going to mean for him.
Which was, he was sort of back on the
instantaneous
covers.
Revival of his career.
Terry Teachout talking about Duke Ellington, and we love our shows about music on Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscow and with Susan Greenbaum, and we have the Kensington Business High School's DECA Marketing Club with us as well. And the club prepares leaders and entrepreneurs for careers in marketing, finance, hospitality, and management in high schools and colleges around the globe. They are here to take your pledge of support. We think you like these shows as well. You told
great.
Us. Because you tuned in and you responded to the show when it first aired today, just an excerpt. And we want you to be a supporter, a member, a subscriber of WHYY, calling right now at 1-888-345-9499. And Susan, we have a goal of, what is it, 80?
Yep, and we've heard from 17 folks.
17, okay, so we're on our way.
Marty, all I want to say is more, more, more. And what I want to say about more is I want to hear more music. That was really terrific as we were sitting here rocking out. And more, we need to hear from more of you. Please do give us a call, 1-888-345-9499. WHYY.org is the place to pledge online. Marty, when we do these music interviews, the producers and Marty, we regroup after the show and we say how great it is to hear music on
yes.
our airwaves. I don't know a lot about music, so this is the kind of show that challenges me to think about music in a different way. Let's talk about challenges. We have a lot of work to do here.
We do have a lot of work to do.
And we need to challenge each and every one of you who are listening to give us a call, show your support, 1-888-345-9499.
And we do many things on Radio Times, part of it reflecting my interest, the interest of the producers, and we think your interest as well. We feel as if, in many ways, we are on the same page with you. We like good music. We want to know about the world. We want to know about local events. We want to know about national political issues. We care about education. All of these are things that we care about. We bring issues and interviews to the airwaves so that you can listen. You can participate, and now we're asking you to take that next step. We do have an ambitious goal for this hour of Radio Times. We need to hear from 80 people. We have not heard from nearly enough yet. I'll be perfectly honest with you. We
Thank
do
you.
Need to stay on track. Thank you for that call. We do want to keep these young students very busy here. They came down, and frankly, if you've been listening to Radio Times, you know what you get. You get in-depth interviews, long-form interviews. You get a chance to participate yourself. That's our philosophy. That's what we do every day. We believe in it, and we believe that you do as well. So again, make a call at 1-888-345-9499, and you can always pledge online at WHYY.org.
And you don't have to make a large investment. You can make an investment that fits your pocketbook. Donations of $5, $10, or $20 per month make a huge difference. Whatever level you feel comfortable with, we appreciate each and every one of your memberships and contributions. And frankly, we really can't do it without each and every one of you. That number is 1-888-345-9499, WHYY.org. And again, as Marty mentioned, we have a great group of students here to take your phone calls, and it's nice to see young smiling faces on a rainy morning. Yeah.
And students on phones, does that seem like an unusual
experience? But they're not talking. Some of them aren't talking.
We want to put students on phones, and we want them to be talking to
you.
And we do appreciate hearing those phone calls coming in. We are going to count each and every one of them until we hit this goal of 80. It's important to stay on track. It is a mini membership drive. We're just going to hopefully do this for 2 days. We started yesterday. We want to end things today. And of course, we can only do that with your pledge of support. So think about what you get every day on Radio Times, the people that you meet, the conversations you get to listen to or to be part of. That's what we do every day.
Thank
and
you.
We want you to be a supporter, a subscriber, a member here at WHYY to keep a show like Radio Times strong. 1-888-345-9499.
We do have a lot of work to do. Our mini gold during this break, or during this hour of Radio Times, is 80 phone calls and pledges online. I'm not sure where we are on that, but we do have work to do. We know that you listen day in and day out. We know that you value it. We know that, honestly, that Marty is one of the reasons you listen, and what she brings to the table enriches your life. Please do give us a call, 1-888-345-9499. WHYY.org is the place to pledge online. And you can get a lot of information on our website.
Absolutely.
It's certainly worth checking out. We're on Twitter. We're on Facebook. We reach out to you. Reach out to us. Give us a call, 1-888-345-9499.
And we've had a nice flurry of calls, and we do want to keep those calls coming in. And as Susan said, you can always pledge online at WHYY.org. It's the best of Radio Times during this hour of the show, in the second hour as well. And it's our way of just reminding you about what a show like Radio Times is about. 1-888-345-9499. Well, one interview that captivated listeners last summer was with neurocriminologist Adrian Rain. He's been studying the psychological origins of crime for many years, including what the brain can tell us. His book, The Anatomy of Violence, is out in paperback. He told us about research he did with murderers using a van with psychophysiology equipment inside.
I would drive the van in the prison in the morning into a secure area, and then a prisoner would be brought to me, and he'd be put into the van and locked inside with me while I tested him. Now, the three prison officers and the two guard dogs around the van, they would take the keys and lock me inside. And, you know, I was really scared the day I tested a hostage taker. What could happen here? You know, is science really that important? What about your life? So it was a bit terrifying at times, but it was also fun and exciting. And, you know, for me, it's a bit of stimulation in life. It's doing something new and different. You know what I mean?
I do know what you mean. But I'm interested, even the sort of then and now of imaging. I mean, what you could look at then in this van parked in the middle of a maximum security prison, and what you can look at today.
It's all changed. And that's the exciting thing about the developments in science and neuroscience, you know, the new brain imaging techniques. Yeah, I didn't have them in my day in the prison. I was using EEG, the electroencephalogram. You put electrodes on your head, you're looking at the electrical activity of the brain. But now we can pop people into brain scanners and look at the physical structure of the brain. I mean, are some people physically different to the rest of us? And those physical differences could cause people to become violent.
Well, in fact, what you have found from some of this imaging is, and looking at a very specific subset of people, these are murderers or psychopaths, that their prefrontal cortex looks different.
It's true. So, you know, we took 41 murderers, we put them into a functional brain scanner, we compared them with 41 normal people, and our key finding there was that the murderers have much poorer functioning in the very frontal region of the brain. You know, the part that sits right above your eyes, it lies behind your forehead. It's just not functioning well in murderers.
And what does that mean? It doesn't light up? It doesn't respond?
Exactly. It doesn't light up as much. I mean, there is something there, but it's just not as activated, as functioning as in normal people. Now, the important question is, what does this do normally? Normally, your frontal cortex is involved in controlling and regulating your behavior. You know, when you have an impulse to do something, the prefrontal cortex says, no, not right now, not at this moment. It's also the part that regulates emotions. I mean, come on, we've all been angry at times. We've always wanted to, you know, whack someone. You know, what stops us? It's the prefrontal cortex. It's the guardian angel on our behavior. And if the guardian angel is asleep, then the devil could come out and somebody could kill.
But would it be fair to say that, and you're looking at a small group of people, we're talking about 41, murderers?
Exactly.
And 41 so-called normal people. It seems to me that the difficulty, of course, is extrapolating from that to the entire population. I mean, can you say that if you have prefrontal cortex anomalies, that would increase your risk for antisocial behavior?
You're quite right. There's an important caveat here. It's not one size fits all. So, you know, like, not all murderers are the same. We had one murderer who killed 64 people in a 12-year period without being caught. Now, what was his frontal cortex like? You know, it lit up like a Christmas tree. It was well activated. You know, what's going on here?
Right.
Well, here we have a man who could carefully plan and regulate his behavior, execute these peoples, clean up the mess afterwards, and then go into work. He was a computer consultant the next morning. You have to have something good going for you to do that. And he had a good frontal cortex allowing him to plan and regulate and stay in control of his victims.
Are we talking about a psychopath here? I mean, someone who,
yes,
who just doesn't have the kind of emotional capacity to care about other people.
That's right. Right, and indeed, when we turn to looking at psychopaths, because we've also brain scanned psychopaths,
right,
one of the more interesting findings we find there is there's a part of the brain deep inside called the amygdala. It's the seat of emotions. It's what generates normal emotions like, you know, conscience, remorse, guilt, empathy, the things that psychopaths don't have.
Mm-hmm.
So when we scan them, Marty, we found that the amygdala is shrunken in size by 18% in these heartless, cold-blooded psychopaths. And that could give us a clue to why they just don't have the feelings of remorse and shame that we do.
Well, and this is something you can't do, but it would be interesting to get brain scans of the entire population of this country, more than 300 million people, in order to see just how much, I guess, of cause and effect some of these anomalies are.
You're so right here. You know, the cause-effect issue is critical, so let me explain that a bit. So is the brain impairment causing the violence, or is it living a violent way of life sort of damages your brain because you get involved in fights? One thing we've done, though, is we took 1,800 three-year-old children. And we
in Mauritius, right?
Yeah, in Mauritius, where I do a lot of my research. It's a small tropical island in the Indian Ocean. And so we measured amygdala functioning in 1,800 three-year-old children. It's an indirect measure, a biological measure of this emotion center. And what we found, we followed up the children for 20 years till they were age 23. Some of them had criminal convictions. And when we compared the criminal offenders at 23 with those who weren't criminal, if we go back in time 20 years ago, we found that the criminals had poor fear. It's called fear conditioning. It's what the amygdala is critically involved in. So we're showing here that, you know, something as early as age 3 is not perfectly predicting to crime, but gives us some predictive power in explaining and predicting to future offending.
But I'm wondering, taking those findings then and maybe even digging into the nurture side, whether you find dysfunctional families or whether you find perhaps accidents or injuries that might explain some of these differences.
Now, I think this is important, yes, because we found this impairment as early as age 3. So that's suggesting that maybe it's really coming on early in life. Maybe it's genetic, neurodevelopmental. But you're quite right. The environment also affects the brain. It's critical. You know, let's take physical child abuse. If a kid's battered around, including his head, that will damage that very frontal region of the brain. There's other early risk factors, like, for example, if a pregnant mum smokes cigarettes during pregnancy, her offspring are 2 to 3 times more likely to become violent criminal offenders 20 years later. If she drinks, you get the same thing. In fact, you can ask, how much would a pregnant mother need to drink per week to raise aggression in her child by 30%? Would it be 30 drinks a week? Would it be 20? Would it be 10? Would it be 5? One drink a week will do it.
What about things like nutrition, for instance?
Nutrition, again, is critically important. So, for example, you know, not our work, but fascinating research of over 1 million pregnant mothers showing if the mothers had poor nutrition during pregnancy, the offspring are 3 times more likely in adulthood to develop what's called antisocial personality disorder, meaning lifelong criminal offending. In our work, we've shown that 3-year-old children with poor nutrition, they are more aggressive and antisocial at ages 8, ages 11, ages 17. It just goes on because poor nutrition impairs the brain.
And it's interesting that we use language like, you know, a cold-hearted killer or crimes of passion. I mean, these are not scientific terms, but perhaps speaking to some of the internal mechanisms.
Exactly. You know, one of the best replicated correlates or biological correlates of aggressive violent behavior is a low resting heart rate. Studies all over the world find the same thing, that, you know, if you measure low resting heart rate in a mildly stressful situation, you know, those with the low resting heart rate relative to people who, you know, respond to a stressor, those low resting heart rate people are much more likely to be violent, antisocial, criminal. What's going on here? The low heart rate during a stressor is measuring a lack of fear, a lack of stress reactivity. And, you know, if you lack fear, you're more likely to do things that, you know, may get punished because you're not concerned, you're not frightened about the potential punishment. I don't know if you remember Ted Kaczynski.
I was just going to say Ted Kaczynski.
The Unabomber. I mean, he was a fearless man sitting there in his camping making these bombs. He could have blown up in a second. He was a very fearless man. And his resting heart rate was 54 beats a minute, really low.
Well, and this is where it gets complicated because you also include your own heart rate in this book, which is even lower than Ted Kaczynski's. Well, you're 48 beats a minute. So what does that tell us?
Well, yeah, well, this is, well, okay. I think what it tells us is that there are supposedly normal people like myself with the biological risk factors. So, I mean, in addition to that, when we brain scanned my brain, it looked very much like that of the serial killer who killed 64 people. Yeah, no. I mean, compare it to the serial
killers, your amygdala, your prefrontal cortex.
And the thalamus. Compare it to a normal, a one-off killer, a serial killer. It's a dead ringer for the serial killers. I had poor nutrition as a kid. Angular stomatitis, cracking of the mouth and lips. That's riboflavin deficiency. So, I mean, what's always fascinated me is, you know, when I was in prison there interviewing the prisoner, I always thought it could have been just the other way around. What made the difference? And, you know, we haven't done great research yet on these protective factors. But just as an individual, you know, for me, I had parents that loved me. And I always had a roof over my head. There was always a meal on the table.
Well, and I don't know much about you, but I was reading a little bit that as a young kid, 9, 10, 11 years old, you were a fire setter. I mean, it sounds like you were a kid either in trouble or certainly a troubled kid.
Yes. And, you know, what I didn't put in the book, I had to be taken to hospital at age 5 to have my stomach pumped because I drank so much alcohol. That was at age 5. So
had you just mistakenly gotten into the liquor cabinet?
Well, it was a Christmas. My brother had been born and there was a lot of alcohol swishing around. So, yeah, I broke into the cocktail cabinet with I drank 3/4 of a bottle of Harvey's Bristol Cream. And so, yes, and, you know, and by the way, maybe all of us have a rough period in life. You know, so mine was from age 9 to 11. I broke out of it. And then, again, it raises the fascinating question, what are the social dynamics that can make a difference? For me, it was, I think, as simple as changing schools, changing my peer group. So, you know what? Peer groups are important. And, you know, later in life, I've had relatively good peers. You know, university professors don't go around killing too many people.
No.
They can be critical. But maybe the social environment is also critical here. Let's not forget the importance of social influences also.
Let me just go back looking at some of these prefrontal cortex issues for criminals. I scribbled down Bernie Madoff. I mean, wouldn't it be interesting to look at white-collar criminals, whether they have some of these same characteristics?
Well, with my colleague Bill Laufer at the Wharton School, we did the first brain imaging study on white-collar criminals, and actually we found something very different in them. We actually found brain enhancements in the white-collar criminals compared to the control group. So parts of the brain involved in executive functions. What's that? That's like what an executive does in business. Planning, regulation, thinking ahead, having the smarts to push the envelope, you know, on trades, for example. And the part of the brain that is very responsive to abstract rewards. What's an abstract reward?
Right.
Money.
Right. Praise.
That part of the brain was actually thicker, physically thicker in the white-collar offenders. So quite the opposite. They have attentional and cognitive brain enhancements that maybe give them an edge up amongst the rest of us in perpetrating white-collar crimes and not getting caught.
A fascinating interview, if I can say so myself, with neurocriminologist Adrian Raine, the author of The Anatomy of Violence. And we were fascinated to book this guest, who happens to be a local fellow. And we know that a lot of people tuned into that interview, and I think you can hear the reasons why. We want you to be a member supporter of WHYY. Give us a call right now, 1-888-345-9499.
Neurocriminology. Where else would you hear about a neurocriminologist? I listen to this segment of Radio Times, and I think this is better than reading an article, which I might not understand, because Marty just does such a good job of bringing this to life, making this relevant to our lives. Cutting-edge research, new knowledge that changes the way you think about something. We have an ambitious goal during this break. We need to hear from about 45 folks in order to meet that goal of 80 members. Please become one of those 50 folks who call 1-888-345-9499. You can also become a member online, whyy.org. If you are listening to us, you're informed, and that really is important.
That phone number again is 1-888-345-9499. We do need to hit this goal of 80 calls. We only need one call from you, though. If you have never been a supporter, subscriber of WHYY, a member of WHYY, do it right now and make it count so that we can meet this goal. And we want to put this mini membership campaign to bed as well. And again, that phone number is 1-888-345-9499. $5, $10 a month. I'm not sure what value you put on news and information. All I know is that that's what we do every day here on Radio Times, Monday through Friday, 10 to 12, weekday mornings. We provide you with the news and information that allows you to understand the world that you live in. And I think, as you heard from the Terry Teachout interview today, you know, we have a chance to kick back and listen to fascinating people talking about fascinating people like Duke Ellington. So give us a call, 1-888-345-9499. Thanks.